Welcome to the Open House Podcast. Conversations exploring life, faith and hope with Stephen O'Doherty.
Well, we are at a critical time in world affairs. The Organisation for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, the OPCW, inspectors have now finally got on-the-ground access to collect samples of soil and human tissue from the sites of alleged chemical weapons attacks in Syria. The attack on civilians in the Syrian city of Douma on the 7th of April killed at least 40 people. The weapons inspectors have been waiting to get access for some time, and there's a real issue about that. Meantime, the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has announced the country has reached its goal of developing a nuclear missile capability and therefore will suspend nuclear missile tests and other missile tests effective immediately and abolish a nuclear test site. Well, that announcement comes, of course, ahead of the planned summits with South Korea and hopefully with the United States. The first of those meetings is scheduled for this coming Friday. What a week it's going to be. Professor John Blaxland is Professor of International Security and Intelligence Studies. He's the head of the Strategic and Defence Studies Centre of the ANU. John Blaxland, welcome to Open House.
Thanks for having me on the program, Stephen.
What are you expecting for this coming Friday?
Well, I think we need to be fairly level-headed about what we're hearing. What we know is that Kim Jong-un has made some promises that sound on the surface very impressive and very magnanimous, if you like, and a very positive gesture indicating a desire for goodwill and for genuine reconciliation. But, we need to be realistic about the nature of the man and the nature of the deal that he's putting on the table. First of all, the nuclear facility that he's talked about closing down is a facility that's actually not working anymore. It's effectively kaput because a number of nuclear weapon tests have already taken place there and the place is no longer effectively usable. So it's a bit of a smoke and mirrors situation we've got here too. And the other thing is he's promised that, well, we're not going to do any more testing before the summit. Well, I'd be shocked if he did.
Yes.
of course, if he was to conduct any more testing before the summit, that would be highly inflammatory and would probably undermine the prospects of the summit ever happening. So these are very impressive-sounding words, but are really hollow gestures.
Well, they are, but nevertheless, he could have, if that's all he was going to do, then he would have held them back until Friday and offered those up as his first thing.
I think the issue is that he's trying to put Trump in a position where Trump's got to offer something as well.
I see.
Otherwise, Trump's going to look not generous and miserly. And so this is about positioning. This is actually quite clever positioning to try and maximize the concessions out of the United States while minimizing the concessions out of North Korea.
So in other words, you're saying that he wants a concession before the talks start from the U.S.?
He needs as many concessions as he can get.
Let's
not forget the sanctions that have been imposed on North Korea are quite heavy sanctions. So they're making life quite difficult for people in North Korea. Now, North Korea is a place that's actually doing better than it was doing in previous times of sanction because they've organised themselves a bit better. So there's a bit of market economics at work, for instance. So there's not this same threat of starvation as has been the case in previous periods of sanction. Mm. So they've got their own internal house in order a bit more. But still, the cut in oil, the cut in trade, the cut in key goods and services is undoubtedly being really felt inside North Korea. And that's something he'd very much be looking for the West to lift up, lift all of those sanctions.
Now, I do remember 12 months ago when he began the round of fairly regular and very risky testing, risky because he was chancing his hand at a retaliation. You said to us, you've got to understand what he's actually doing is he's trying to make himself a nuclear nation so he can deal himself into this round, into the game.
Indeed.
And that's exactly what he's done. And he said it himself this week, I am now a nuclear power. So you are absolutely right, but you've got to hand it to him for getting to this point. But was it only to get to the point where he was able to trade off the sanctions?
No, this is the start point of the game. he obviously would like to do more than that. I think basically behind all of this, I think he would still like to unify Korea under Pyongyang, the rule of Pyongyang. But short of that, he wants to neutralize the threat from the Americans and the West through South Korea. So, and that's, I think, something that the Chinese would probably be very happy about as well. So there's more to this than just this, you know, this offer of a deal with scaling back the nuclear program and denuclearizing the peninsula. Well, what does that mean? What does it mean to denuclearize the peninsula? Well, essentially, you know, that's a million-dollar question that's been very, very opaquely defined. And that's where the rub will be. Does that mean the United States has to leave South Korea? Does that mean North Korea remains in a position where it could actually challenge South Korea? Yeah. And what are the implications for Japan? Japan looks on with quite a high degree of trepidation about what the implications are.
Because, does it mean no fly zones? Does it mean no sail zones? Because you could demilitarize the peninsula fully, but you've still got American warships and others floating up and down within striking range.
Yes, but that's far harder to sustain if you don't have a presence on the ground. And this is something that is very worrying for the Japanese. The Japanese have seen Korea as kind of like the forward base, a bit of a shield for them, because knowing that the United States military presence in Korea is effectively a buffer for Japan from China. If that goes away, that raises the level of fear and alarm inside Japan. And there's, I believe, a fairly realistic prospect of Japan wanting to go nuclear, in other words, get nuclear weapons. So that then has an escalatory effect on the tensions in the whole of that Northeast Asian space. So there's a whole series of potential permutations from one action to another in this space. It's very hard to actually think through carefully how to manage this effectively without this actually unraveling quite gravely.
Oh, absolutely. What will the South Koreans be hoping for, and what pressure will they put on the US to gain something that they want?
Well, the government in South Korea has been quite, you know, before it came to office, has been quite conciliatory towards the North. So they, I think, are prepared to be more optimistic than probably others in the Trump administration might be. So exactly what they expect, it's hard to know. I mean, what they say and what they do are two different things, probably, because they've got to be mindful that they are in a very tricky situation at the moment. They know that Kim Jong-un is a crafty and cunning political player. They know that China has a stake in the equation here too. That's why Kim Jong-un went to see Xi Jinping in Beijing only a couple of weeks ago. And so they don't want to be the meat in the sandwich here. They've got to play their cards very carefully so that the United States doesn't walk away and leave them in a predicament that's worse than their current one. And that's where North Korea remains armed with its conventional weapons capability that could effectively obliterate the capital of Seoul in a matter of minutes, without the United States being able to provide them with a security blanket. That's a scary proposition.
Well, how much of this can we actually attribute to Donald Trump?
Well, look, this is the man who's behind the art of the deal. And his brinkmanship is certainly bringing people to the table to negotiate a deal. But when you play a game of brinkmanship like this, when the stakes are high, you can win big or you can lose big. And that's, I think, what is really the most worrying thing at the moment, is that if this unravels, if this goes pear-shaped, this could actually end up in the situation deteriorating quite rapidly. Now, he is hoping and praying that that doesn't happen. And hopefully sanity and wisdom will prevail. But, you know, you've got to wonder about the people that President Trump has surrounded himself with. John Bolton is, you know, widely regarded as somebody who's quite hawkish and essentially an unreconstructed, you know, defender of the invasion of Iraq in 2003, despite everything that's happened in the meantime in that space. And Mike Pompeo, to his credit, his insiders are saying this guy's hawkish but fairly sensible. You know, and there, of course, there are conflicting views on Mike Pompeo as well. But
yes.
Well, it's so hard to figure out how this is going to go. Trump does not have a team of seasoned career watchers close by to provide him that kind of support that you would expect a president to have going into this once-in-a-lifetime type of negotiation with a very cunning political operative in Kim Jong-un.
Our guest on Open House is John Blaxland from the Australian National University Strategic Studies Institute. John, it's not as if Donald Trump and his key advisers haven't got other things to worry about as well. And, of course, we're watching Syria unfold virtually in real time. The chemical weapons inspectors finally got in, I think, yesterday. I wonder how long it'll take before they're able to validate that it was chemical weapons used by the Assad regime against those people.
Well, I've been watching the news feeds over the last couple of hours, and apparently there's already indication that there's nothing here to be seen, folks. Which isn't all that surprising, given that they were held out of the area for about a week due to apparent security concerns, which I must confess, it does reek of some, you know, cover-up. How is it that journalists could get in there and have a look around, but the OPCW, which is the authority that really could check this,
yes,
was prevented from gaining access in a timely manner to verify the status of the site. It does generate real concerns about the credibility of what the Syrians have been doing and what the Russians have been doing in cahoots with the Syrians.
Does it, if that turns out to be the case, does that then raise some serious implications for the allies who went in and conducted those retaliation missile firings, those retaliation strikes last week?
Look, I think, Stephen, we've got to remember there's quite a lot of, you know, what the Russians call maskirovka going on here, masquerade, or, you know, basically deception operations. Mm. The Russians have a stake in the Bashar al-Assad regime. They want to prop him up. They want him not to fail. They have invested heavily in his regime, and that's because they have a stake in the sea and airports up on the northwestern Mediterranean coast of Syria. So Russia is playing a long game in terms of its relationship with Syria to hold on there. So it will protect Bashar al-Assad, even when they, behind the scenes, may think, what on earth, you know, be critical and think he's being stupid. They won't dump him because they have such a big stake in his livelihood and in his the regime surviving. So, you know, it's a tricky situation, but we do know that there was compelling evidence, and the World Health Organization confirmed this, of the chemical attack that warranted a international response. Now, the UN Security Council was the body that you would have normally have turned to for some kind of international sanction, some kind of legitimacy for an international intervention. But, of course, with the Russian veto, that was never going to happen. Mm. Russia was going to protect its client state in Syria. But France, Britain, and the United States saw, I believe, the normative implications of allowing this red line to be crossed. And when I say the normative implications, we have come to accept in the world today one of the norms being that chemical weapons are banned. You don't use chemical weapons.
Yeah.
And when you start saying it's okay, we're not going to punish anybody if they do use chemical weapons.
Yeah.
You are then basically opening the floodgates to more such perpetrations of grave crimes and atrocities.
Yeah, so the Russians then kind of allowed, sanctioned, as you say, a normative retaliation attack. But the question might be, how many more of these sorts of incidents? But it's about 12 months probably, or maybe was it 9 months?
About a year since the last one. Yeah,
so how many more of these do we see? And then do you get Do you get the prospect that America is caught in a pincer action escalation in the Middle East where they don't actually even want to be there? North Korea, a very high-handed game being played where the stakes are the highest of all.
Exactly. Well, the thing is, though, that what's clear, and this has come out over the last few days, is that the Russians deconflicted with the Americans as to what was acceptable for them to, and what missions to undertake. And they made very clear where they were and what they didn't want to see happen. And so the United States, with Britain and France, struck at legitimate targets. They struck at the chemicals research facility, the weapons development facility, and the storage facility that are directly related to the use of chemical weapons. I don't see how anybody can have a real problem with that. This is an odious regime. The Assad regime has a track record repeatedly of using this kind of chemical weapons and barrel bombs. And an action like this to check the extreme inhumanity of the Assad regime, who can possibly have an issue with that? Look, and even the Russians, in recognizing the deconfliction, while the public relations campaign proceeds relentlessly critical of the West for doing this, the bottom line is they recognise that that was not unreasonable for the United States to lead that action.
Professor John Blaxland is with us. Well, John, you know well this program and our aim to look at life through the lens of faith and point to hope. Mm. Where would you be pointing to hope at a time like this?
My hope is that the crisis that we've seen unfold in the last few days may actually have a cathartic effect to generate a space, an opening for some kind of reconciliation whereby the United States, Russia, and the other players can find a way for Syria to move beyond violence to a resolution of the political challenge they face with some kind of federal structure. Now, that's a model that's been put up a number of times now. It's actually hard to see this come to fruition in the short term, partly because of the hands of Iran and the clash with Israel. And this is a very big part of the equation. We know that the Israelis feel that they face an existential threat, particularly from Hezbollah in Lebanon and in the Golan Heights. That has been reinforced by the actions of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. And Trump's talk about leaving Syria, which is what predated the chemical weapons attack only by a few days, speaks, in my mind, to a US administration not quite understanding how there are knock-on consequences to America's actions. So while there are people out there who'd say America should just get out, the bottom line is, today, the United States cannot walk away from its legacy there. It has invested enormously in trying to rehabilitate Iraq under Haider al-Abadi and deal with Daesh, the threat from the so-called IS group, which has been remarkably successful over the last couple of years. To walk away from Syria now, I believe, would leave the ground exposed for the Iranians to exploit the connections in Syria. It would leave the Kurds, being the Americans' allies in this campaign, gravely exposed to Turkish and Iranian pressure. And it would leave Israel vulnerable. And I don't know many people of faith who would see that is a good thing.
Certainly not. Well, every year at Anzac Day, and I was at an Anzac service this afternoon. You know, I sit there, we all do, and we wonder at the dreadful cost of human life through all of these actions, and then you think about what's currently going on and you say, is it ever worth it? You seem to be saying, John, that nevertheless, if our faith is in a coalition outcome there, a federation outcome in the Middle East, then the price of moving towards that is yet that we have to continue to see effectively police operations continuing in that region.
I think so. Look, the thing is, Steve, you know, ideally we wouldn't be in this predicament. We would have nipped this in the bud 6 years ago.
Yes.
But we can't unwind the clock. We have to deal with the world we face today. Mm-hmm. And we face the world today that is messy and that is compounded problems based on the mistakes and decisions of the past. We live with them today, and we have to make the best we can of the circumstances we face. And in Syria today, as I say, we face a very very kind of militant Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. We find Assad getting increasingly confident with the Russian support. Yes. We find IS or Daesh completely on the back foot, almost completely quashed, but not completely, and yet other extremist elements still alive and well. We have the Kurds there who have been pushed back and who are feeling quite vulnerable because of Iran and Turkey and the fact the United States is prevaricating over its future. It's hard to see a scenario now where a US withdrawal will end well. The United States has to remain engaged. It's broadly recognized this in terms of its investment in Iraq. It saw that when it walked away from Iraq in 2011, things went gravely pear-shaped. So there's a recognition now that with Iraq, the United States has to remain, and this is one of the reasons why Australia still has a presence there. It's a presence I've questioned in the past, but I recognize Australia has a vested interest in having invested so far over the last decade and a half in not letting it completely unravel again. And that has implications for what happens in Syria. Now, Australia hasn't played a very prominent role in Syria. We've done some airstrikes over using our Air Force assets, but that's wound back now. But for the United States, it is the one power that it can actually keep in check the machinations of the Bashar al-Assads of the world and the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. So as we think about what the future might look like, if the United States to withdraw from Syria entirely, what freedom of action would that give to Assad and to his Iranian backers and to the Russians? That's not something that I particularly want to contemplate all that much.
John Blackstone, it's awfully good of you to give us your time and your wisdom. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on our program, Steve.
Discover more Open House podcasts at openhousecommunity.com.au.